This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Friday, June 4th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. The news about the pandemic is promising. More than half of all Americans have received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. Almost every state in the country is rapidly easing its masking and other restrictions. And as schools, museums, and businesses open up again, a semblance of pre-pandemic life has resumed. Still, it's hard to read the economy. It's showing the strains of the past year and the sudden reemergence of life almost as usual. Although consumers are eager to spend, supply chains are bottlenecked. Unemployment is just under 6%, yet many employers are having trouble filling jobs. Fiscal conservatives have been warning that President Biden's American Jobs and American Families plans represent a reckless series of tax and spend policies. He waved aside those concerns last week in his proposed $6 trillion federal budget for 2022. In a speech in Cleveland, he appeared unconcerned about deficit spending and the threat of inflation, reiterating his confidence in the wisdom and necessity of greatly expanding benefits to struggling Americans and in upgrading the nation's infrastructure.
Fixing those problems can help build a more dynamic, innovative economy, and we're going to have a lot more to say about that in the days ahead. But this is already clear. We're on the right track. The American Rescue Plan laid a strong foundation for a new economy that brings everybody along. But it's just the first step. We're going to build on the incentive and incredible progress that we've made and set America on a sustainable path to faster, more inclusive economic growth.
John Cassidy, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to make sense of conflicting stories about the post-pandemic jobs market and to discuss the potential long-term effects of Bidenomics. John, we really need your clarity this week. I'm glad to have you back, both about the immediate picture and about how Biden's plans could play out for both parties. So maybe let's start with the jobs report for May, which just came out hours ago. What should we make of it?
Yes, we just got the May jobs figures, and they were reasonably encouraging, I'd say. The headline figure was payrolls were up 559,000, which was twice last month's figure. If you remember, there was a big kerfuffle about the April figures, which came in much lower than expected at 278,000. This month, it was double that at, as I said, 559,000. The unemployment rate, which was 6.1% in April, fell to 5.8% in May. And the number of unemployed also fell back a bit. So, you know, last month, if there was a big scare last month that perhaps there'd been a huge hiccup in the economy, I think that that's now been shown not to be the case. The recovery is continuing, and it shows that as the economy reopens and the vaccine number of people vaccinated increases, people are still getting back to work across the country.
Yet it's hard for me, at least, to parse the fact, as I understand it, that 10 million Americans are still out of work, yet employers are reporting that 8 million jobs are available. What's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big puzzle to economists and analysts, and there's been big debate about it over the last month or two. There's no resolution. There are two basic stories out there, which I think, you know, split along political lines, basically. Republicans and conservatives are claiming that the main factor here is the expansion of unemployment benefits and the fact that quite a few people are receiving unemployment benefits as much or, in some cases, more than what they were receiving working, and they're saying that that's the reason why people aren't going back to work. Lots of independent economists say that's a factor. Nobody doubts that it's a factor in some cases. It's not the main factor. The main factor is just the enormous dislocation we've experienced because of COVID-19 in terms of closures. A lot of people have moved. Some people are still struggling with childcare. Some schools are still closed. And it's just been this enormous shock to the economy, and it's going to take some time for it to all work out and things to get back to normal. This jobs report doesn't resolve that that argument either way. In fact, I think that argument's going to go on for months. You can already see the response to in the immediate response to the jobs report. President Biden put out a statement saying this report shows that America's on the move again. Basically, the policies are working. And the Republican, one of the top Republicans on Capitol Hill, Kevin Brady, put out a statement saying, no, it's the opposite. If you look at the labor force participation rate, that's the percentage of people who are working or looking for work, it's still well below where it was before the pandemic. And that's because of Biden's big spending plans and his proposed tax increases and the unemployment checks, etc. So I think that we see framed there how the political debate is going to play out, and at least until the midterms.
Right. So there are Republicans' argument is that these stimulus checks and the generous unemployment benefits have convinced people at the lower end of the income scale that they're better off not returning to work. And I've read that 25 Republican-led states so far are planning this summer to cut the expanded federal unemployment benefits. What do you make of all of that?
Well, I think we'll have to wait and see if that makes very much difference. It's only going to be 3 months here. The expanded benefits run out in September anyway, and there's been some talk among people close to the White House that at that stage they may support transitioning into a system in which you get a bonus for going back to work, which would probably be, you know, a reasonable idea. I mean, it's the idea that nobody's going back to work because everybody's staying on unemployment benefits just isn't sustained by the by these job figures. People are going back to work and taking these jobs if they're available. It's not as if there are no workers out there willing to go back to work. That's just a political argument rather than an economic one that's being put forward.
You know, the broader political dynamic is fascinating to watch. Biden clearly sees this as a transitional period and an opportunity to make sweeping socioeconomic changes. And workers in low wage and essential jobs seem to agree. And so there's been some pressure, you know, to raise the minimum wage in some of these jobs. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how, if you agree with this, that how the pandemic has changed the relationship between workers and wages.
At this stage, you just have to look at the hiring, the job opening figures. There are a record number of job openings out there relative to workers. So for the first time in many years, this sort of balance of power in the labour market is on the side of people who are looking for work rather than employers. That's the economic fact of the situation. So you see that in, for example, the restaurant trade and the bar trade. If these latest job figures, sorry to keep going back to them, but they showed that hourly work of people working in that sector increased by about a dollar last month. I think I've got the actual figure somewhere. It went from $14.80 an hour to $15.90 an hour. So that's a dollar an hour. That's a lot of money compared to the raises we've seen over the last 10, 20, even 30 years. So as I say, in economic terms, what you've got here paradoxically is a sort of tight labour market in which employers who want to reopen these restaurants and bars and hotels, etc., are having to offer higher wages to attract workers. And, you know, in my opinion, that's a good thing, because one of the great problems we've faced in the last 20 or 30 years is wage stagnation and rising inequality. So at least in the short term, one of the sort of paradoxical effects of the pandemic, this great economic shock and this great tragedy, is that it has led to an increase in wages at the bottom end.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, POD15, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
And then looking ahead a little bit, what exactly does Biden's hoped-for 2022 budget contain? He made it clear in his written statement to Congress that it's a rebuke to Reaganism, saying that trickle-down economics has never worked and that the best way to strengthen the economy is from the bottom up, not from the top down.
Yes, I mean, I think you got it exactly right, Dorothy, when you said that Biden's trying to use this take the pandemic as an opportunity to basically restructure American politics and American political economy to an extent that we haven't seen since the Reagan years. The budget basically put that vision into figures. The $6 trillion headline was obviously a big one. But if the best way to look at this stuff, if you want to look at the size of the government relative to the past, the best way is not to look at the dollar figure, but to look at the size of the government relative to GDP. And what you see if you do that is for the last 50 years or so, basically the federal government has spent about 21% of GDP, and it's taken in about 17% in revenues taxation. So there's a structural budget deficit there of 3 or 4%, which has just been there going back forever. Well, not forever, but since the Reagan era. What the Biden budget lays out is a plan in which both of these numbers would basically take a step jump, sort of unprecedented step jump, really. And the spending as a percentage of GDP would go from 21% to 25% over the next 10 years, and revenues would go from 17% to about 20% over the 21% over the next 10 years. So basically, both sides of the equation, spending and revenues, would jump about 4% of GDP, which in historic terms is a big and monumental increase in the size of government. Where would all the money go? Well, Biden has laid out his plans. He's got two basic ones, the American Jobs Plan, which is the infrastructure plan, and the American Families Plan, which is about a big increase in child credits, the sort of social, what I call social infrastructure. That's the vision which Biden is laying out, and the next few months in Capitol Hill and Washington generally is all going to be about how the Democrats are going to push through that agenda.
Given the state of affairs in Congress, what are the chances of getting a budget passed that remotely resembles Biden's ideal?
Well, I think, you know, I think the chances are pretty good that there will be a big spending package or two big spending packages in the next few months. In order to do that, Biden has to bring along, obviously, everybody in the Senate and almost everybody in the House. So he may have to trim his plans here and there. But I think once we get through this, there's two things happening. Number one, there are these negotiations going on with the Republicans and with Shelley Moore Capito about an infrastructure package. Seems to me both sides are still a long way apart on that. And I think most people on Capitol Hill believe that that's basically political theater, and in the next week or two, those talks will break down, and the Democrats will, and the White House will then shift to pushing their infrastructure package through what's known as budget reconciliation, for which they can do with 51 votes in the Senate. And of course, that means they have to bring along Senator Manchin and Sinema and some other moderates. But I think they will be able to do that. As I say, they might have to row back in certain areas. After that, they would move on to the American Families Plan, which is a lot of, as I say, the social programs and social infrastructure, which is very popular with Democrats. And that would be a second bill to put through. Now, conceivably, they could roll it all into one huge spending package, but at the moment, it looks like two packages are more likely.
And do you think Biden's going to be able to beat back all of the fears of inflation? Does he have a good, strong enough counter-argument to that?
Well, I think it depends on what happens to the inflation figures over the next few months. I don't think, you know, 1 or 2 months of a pickup, as we've seen, is going to be enough to completely change the political environment. As I said, one of the reasons that inflation's picked up a bit is that wages have picked up a bit, which Democrats all support. The Federal Reserve still seems relatively, not too worried about the situation. They're making the argument this is just a temporary uptick in inflation because of supply chain pressures and the other things you mentioned, basically the dislocation of the economy due to the pandemic. So I don't think inflation is going to be a showstopper here in the next few months. I may be wrong. There could be a, you know, really outrageous inflation figure in the next few months, which would change things. But if things continue as they are, with a sort of slow tick up in inflation, I don't think that's going to be a political showstopper.
So maybe you mentioned the filibuster. Let's go back to that for a second, because that seems to be key to getting this program passed. Joe Manchin, you mentioned, and Kyrsten Sinema, it seems unlikely that Manchin in particular is going to change his mind about the filibuster, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you on that. I mean, one of the advantages that Biden has is that the economic stuff can be pushed through on reconciliation, so the filibuster doesn't really come into that. He needs 60 votes for his broader agenda on voting reforms and issues which don't involve direct spending by the government. But anything which affects the budget, or most things that affect the budget, can be passed through reconciliation. So the filibuster isn't going to stop Biden getting everything through. He doesn't need 60 votes for his economic plan through. He doesn't need 60 votes to pass that. He needs 51, and of course he needs to pass the House, which is also pretty narrow. But as I say, that's just a matter, or not just, that is a matter of keeping the moderate Democrats on board. And Biden himself is ultimately a moderate Democrat, and I think he will be able to bring those along with him. The question is, can he keep the progressive wing of the party on his side as he makes some concessions to the moderates in order to keep everybody together?
And I haven't looked at polls lately, but so far my understanding is that the these big, bold policies of the Biden administration are very popular.
Yeah, I mean, if you poll them individually, they are. I mean, you know, people, obviously, everybody is in favour of childcare. There's strong support for child tax credits, which would have a big impact on reducing child poverty. Green infrastructure is very popular. There's a general acceptance that we need to take serious measures to tackle global warming, climate change. So, yeah, individually, these are all very, not all, but most of them are very popular policies. The question is, can you frame them as part of a coherent plan? And can you fight off the Republican counteroffensives, which is always going to be on the tax side of it, and claim that a lot of the stuff is wasted? Now, you know, in the 80s and 90s, and even more recently, Democrats struggled to frame sort of spending policies and government programs on their own basis, rather than as part of this Republican frame, which was all about taxes and waste. What Biden is trying to do here is, you know, overturn that history and persuade people that the government is part of the solution, not only part of the solution, is an essential part of how we construct an economy in the 21st century, when we have to tackle issues like climate change, rising inequality, and social inclusion. So, you know, this is a historic debate. I mean, we can, you know, obviously a day-to-day basis, it's just a partisan back and forth. But it really is a historical debate going on about the future shape of the country.
And speaking of the 80s and 90s, I can't resist going all the way back to Bill Clinton's successful 1992 campaign against the incumbent, President George H.W. Bush. And it was all basically distilled in the phrase, "It's the economy, stupid." The country's politics have changed so dramatically since then, and are continuing to do so, as you've just been saying. Does that still hold true?
I mean, the economy is obviously still an enormous factor, and many political analysts believe it still is the biggest factor in determining elections. But there is also evidence over the last 10 or 15 years that it's perhaps not quite as important as it used to be. And the reason is the overwhelming rise of political polarization that we've seen, which seems, according to quite a lot of polling, to overwhelm almost all individual factors, including the economy. So I think going into 2022, the economy, yes, is going to be an enormous factor, but it's going to be a factor in the context of this incredible polarization we have, which I think is still the overwhelming factor. But that doesn't mean the economy is not important, because obviously elections are decided at the margin. So if the economic conditions can even impact the, you know, the votes of 10 or 15% of the population, that can be decisive in elections. So I'm not trying to downgrade the the economy, it's still obviously a crucial factor.
Thanks so much, John.
Thank you, Dorothy. It's been fun talking.
John Cassidy, a staff writer at The New Yorker, is the author of How Markets Fail, The Rise and Fall of Free Market Economics. It's out in a new edition this month. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.